it's a little past 8:30, so let's get started. My name is David Wee. I'm a retired English professor from St. Olaf College. So I've spent my lifetime with words and writers and student writers, and I love language and literature, and what I'm going to do this week is have five sessions. Each of them is called An Hour with the Poets. And today it's Billy Collins. On Saturday it will be another laureate, a Nobel laureate, Wisława Szymborska, a Polish woman who won the Nobel Prize for Literature. And then on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, I'm going to read and talk with you, and you're welcome to respond to everything. Tomorrow, a book of poems people have written about cancer. Some poems written by cancer sufferers, some by their caretakers, some by their family and spouses, discussing the process of living with cancer in the family. And on Friday, it will be a similar kind of presentation with a book of poetry about Alzheimer's disease. And again, by people who are coping with Alzheimer's disease somewhere in the family and finding that writing poetry or reading poetry is a helpful way to get through the agony of that. And then on Wednesday, I'll be introducing a national project called America's Favorite Poems. Another U.S. Poet Laureate invited people like you and me all over the country to tell him and his staff what was our favorite poem and why. You know, to write just a few sentences to explain why this poem is meaningful to me. And it's a fascinating book, and I'll read some of the, not only some of the poems to you, but some of the people's reasons why they love this poem. And then if some of the audience has poems that are their favorites, we can talk about yours as well a little bit. So this time it's the poetry of Billy Collins, and you can sit back and relax and laugh. I warn you, you'll be wanting to laugh on occasion at his poetry. And if at any point you wish to make a comment, as I'll do after some of the poems, why, just chip right in and share what responses you have. There are several copies of this book in the bookstore. So if you find afterwards that you'd love to have more, there you can get it. So what I'll do is pick out selected poems. And the nice thing about teaching here, just as Fred said this morning, you can do what you want to do instead of what the curriculum committee or the department decides got to be covered in this course. And this is a wonderful way to engage in the things we love in our teaching. First one I'm going to read is called Introduction to Poetry. And like many American poets, Billy Collins has spent part of his life as an English professor at a college or university. And so you're going to hear in some of his poetry echoes of his experience with students and the academic life and poetry. And I think you'll find these poems to be not very complex, and yet I would consider it profound. And this is one poem where he talks about the difficulty with those of us who are interpreting literature, you know, trying to get it, figure it out. Introduction to Poetry. I ask them take a poem and hold it up to the light like a color slide, or press an ear against its hive. I say drop a mouse into a poem and watch him probe his way out, or walk inside the poem's room and feel the walls for a light switch. I want them to water ski across the surface of a poem, waving at the author's name on the shore. But all they want to do, and they is the students, all they want to do is tie the poem to a chair with rope and torture a confession out of it. They begin beating it with a hose to find out what it really means. And that's, of course, the thing we all have to beware against, insisting that every poem means a certain thing, and the professor knows what that one thing is, and you have to try to guess, if you're a college student, you know, what answer the professor wants to hear. Well, here's another poem where he talks about the difficulty with teaching poetry and getting young people to understand it. This one is called, and it's from this other book, the most recent book by Billy Collins called Ballistics. This first book is Sailing Alone Around the Room. This one is called The Effort. I noticed that you've got the book. Do you want to be reading along? I can give page numbers as we go if that's helpful.
Yeah, but okay, I've got the other one.
Oh, you have just the other one. Okay. The effort. Would anyone care to join me in flicking a few pebbles in the direction of teachers who are fond of asking the question, what is the poet trying to say? As if Thomas Hardy and Emily Dickinson had struggled but ultimately failed in their efforts. Inarticulate wretches that they were. Fighting their pens and staring out the window for a clue. Yes, it seems that Whitman, Amy Lowell, and the rest could only try and fail, but we in Mrs. Parker's third period English class here at Springfield High will succeed with the help of these study questions in saying what the poor poet could not. And we will get all this done before that orgy of egg salad and tuna fish known as lunch. Tonight, however, I am the one trying to say what it is this absence means, the two of us sleeping and waking under different roofs. The image of this vase of cut flowers, not from our garden, is no help. And the same goes for the single plate, the solitary lamp, and the weather that presses its face against these new windows, the drizzle and the morning frost. So I will leave it up to Mrs. Parker, who is tapping a piece of chalk against the blackboard, and her students, a few with their hands up, others slouching with their caps on backwards, to figure out what it is I am trying to say about this place where I find myself, and to do it before the noon bell rings and that whirlwind of meatloaf is unleashed. Okay. And if any of you say, I feel his pain, or...
Which pain?
Okay, this one is going to be page 18. It's called Schoolsville. And this is a good one for those of us who have been teachers. Glancing over my shoulder at the past, I realize the number of students I have taught is enough to populate a small town. And I've found half a dozen of them here just this week at Holman. I can see it nestled in a paper landscape, this small town. Chalk dust flying down in winter, nights dark as a blackboard. The population ages, but never graduates. On hot afternoons, they sweat the final in the park, and when it's cold, they shiver around stoves, reading disorganized essays out loud. The bell rings on the hour, and everybody zigzags into the street with their books. I forgot all their last names first, and their first names last, in alphabetical order. But the boy who always had his hand up is an alderman and owns the haberdashery. The girl who signed her papers in lipstick leans against the drugstore, smoking, brushing her hair like a machine. Their grades are sewn into their clothes like references to Hawthorne. The A's stroll along with other A's. The D's honk whenever they pass another D. All the creative writing students recline on the courthouse lawn and play the lute. Yeah. Wherever they go, they form a big circle. Needless to say, I am the mayor. I live in the White Colonial at Maple and Main. I rarely leave the house. The car deflates in the driveway. Vines twirl around the porch swing. Once in a while, a student knocks on the door with a term paper 15 years late. Or a question about Yates or double spacing. And sometimes one will appear in a window pane to watch me lecturing the wallpaper, quizzing the chandelier, reprimanding the air. Here's one called The Death of Allegory. And one of the things that has puzzled all of us as we read texts, whether it's the Bible or novels or poetry, is the way in which writers, poets in particular, tend to wish to talk about human truths, abstract ideas, by using concrete language. Words that appeal to specific visual things. You know, some of those are what we call allegories. This one's on page 27. The death of allegory. And each of these allegories or the condition it represents is capitalized in here. Truth, chastity, these are all capitalized. I am wondering what became of all those tall abstractions that used to pose, robed and statuesque, in paintings and parade about on the pages of the Renaissance, displaying their capital letters like license plates. Truth cantering on a powerful horse. Chastity, eyes downcast, fluttering with veils. Each one was marble come to life, a thought in a coat. Courtesy, bowing with one hand always extended. Villainy sharpening an instrument behind a wall. Reason with her crown and constancy alert behind a helm. They are all retired now, these allegories, consigned to a Florida for tropes. Justice is there standing by an open refrigerator. Valor lies in bed listening to the rain. Even death has nothing to do but mend his cloak and hood. And all their props are locked away in a warehouse, hourglasses, globes, blindfolds, and shackles. Even if you called them back, there are no places left for them to go. No garden of mirth or bower of bliss. The valley of forgiveness is lined with condominiums, and chainsaws are howling in the forest of despair. Here on the table next to the window is a vase of peonies, and next to it, black binoculars and a money clip, exactly the kind of thing we now prefer, objects that sit quietly on a line in lower case, themselves and nothing more, a wheelbarrow, an empty mailbox, a razor blade resting in a glass ashtray. As for the others, the great ideas on horseback, and the long-haired virtues in embroidered gowns, it looks as though they have traveled down the road you see on the final page of storybooks, The one that winds up a green hillside and disappears into an unseen valley where everyone must be fast asleep. And this, for those of us of a certain age, is, for me, very effective. It's page 29. It's called Forgetfulness. The name of the author is the first to go, followed immediately by the title, the plot, the heartbreaking conclusion, the entire novel, which suddenly becomes one you have never read, never even heard of. As if, one by one, the memories you used to harbor decided to retire to the southern hemisphere of the brain, to a little fishing village where there are no phones. Long ago, you kissed the names of the nine muses goodbye and watched the quadratic equation pack its bag. And even now, as you memorize the order of the planets, something else is slipping away, a state flower, perhaps, the address of an uncle, the capital of Paraguay. Whatever it is you are struggling to remember, it is not poised on the tip of your tongue, not even lurking in some obscure corner of your spleen. It has floated away down a dark mythological river whose name begins with an L, as far as you can recall. Well on your own way to oblivion, where you will join those who have even forgotten how to swim and how to ride a bicycle. No wonder you rise in the middle of the night to look up the date of a famous battle in a book on war. No wonder the moon in the window seems to have drifted out of a love poem that you used to know by heart.
Wow.
Now the thing I love about Billy Collins is I hope you are picking up is how his use of metaphor moves into the absurd, into the fantastical, into the impossible, but never leaving behind the idea that he's trying to get across about the agony of forgetfulness in this case, or a lifetime as a teacher, and now you live in a place called Schoolsville, where you are the mayor. This one is page 47, entitled Consolation. How agreeable it is not to be touring Italy this summer, wandering her cities and ascending her torrid hill towns. How much better to cruise these local familiar streets, fully grasping the meaning of every road sign and billboard, and all the sudden hand gestures of my compatriots. These are for those of us who are not in another hemisphere at this moment. There are no abbeys here, no crumbling frescoes or famous domes, and there is no need to memorize a succession of kings or tour the dripping corners of a dungeon. No need to stand around the sarcophagus, see Napoleon's little bed on Elba, or view the bones of a saint under glass. How much better to command the simple precinct of home than be dwarfed by pillar, arch, and basilica. Why hide my head in phrase books and wrinkled maps? Why feed scenery into a hungry one-eyed camera, eager to eat the world one monument at a time? Instead of slouching in a cafe, ignorant of the word for ice, I will head down to the coffee shop and the waitress known as Dot. I will slide into the flow of the morning paper, all language barriers down, rivers of idiom running freely, eggs over easy on the way. And after breakfast, I will not have to find someone willing to photograph me with my arm around the owner. I will not puzzle over the bill or record in a journal what I had to eat and how the sun came in the window. It is enough to climb back into the car as if it were the great car of English itself, and sounding my loud vernacular horn, speed off down a road that will never lead to Rome, not even Bologna. The blessings of staying home. Here's one where he goes back to growing up experience. It's on page 63 and is entitled On Turning 10. The age 10. The whole idea of it makes me feel like I'm coming down with something. Something worse than any stomach ache or the headaches I get from reading bad light. A kind of measles of the spirit. A mumps of the psyche. A disfiguring chicken pox of the soul. You tell me it is too early to be looking back, but that is because you have forgotten the perfect simplicity of being one and the beautiful complexity introduced by two. But I can lie on my bed and remember every digit. At 4, I was an Arabian wizard. I could make myself invisible by drinking a glass of milk a certain way. At 7, I was a soldier. At 9, a prince. But now I am mostly at the window, watching the late afternoon light. Back then, it never fell so solemnly against the side of my treehouse, and my bicycle never leaned against the garage as it does today, all the dark blue speed drained out of it. This is the beginning of sadness, I say to myself, as I walk through the universe in my sneakers. It is time to say goodbye to my imaginary friends. Time to turn the first big number. It seems only yesterday I used to believe that there was nothing under my skin but light. If you cut me, I would shine. But now when I fall upon the sidewalks of life, I skin my knees. I bleed. 10 years old. Huge transition. All of childhood. This one is called Dancing Toward Bethlehem. If there's only enough time in the final minutes of the 20th century for one last dance, I would like to be dancing it slowly with you, say in the ballroom of a seaside hotel. My palm would press into the small of your back as the past 100 years collapsed into a pile of mirrors or buttons or frivolous shoes. Just as the floor of the 19th century gave way and disappeared in a red cloud of brick dust. There will be no time to order another drink or worry about what was never said. Not with the orchestra sliding into the sea and all our attention devoted to humming whatever it was they were playing. The passage of time. There's a very short one, 11 lines. Man in space. All you have to do is listen to the way a man sometimes talks to his wife at a table of people and notice how intent he is on making his point, even though her lower lip is beginning to quiver. And you will know why the women in science fiction movies who inhabit a planet of their own are not pictured making a salad or reading a magazine when the men from Earth arrive in their rocket. Why they are always standing in a semicircle with their arms folded, their bare legs set apart, their breasts protected by hard metal discs. It's a very sad one, actually, but in a humorous, unexpected way. And this is especially good for English majors and lovers of poetry. It's the longest one I'm going to read. It's just 2 pages, but it's entitled, on page 119, taking off Emily Dickinson's clothes. First, her tippet made of tulle, easily lifted off her shoulders and laid on the back of a wooden chair. In her bonnet, the bow undone with a light forward pull. Then the long white dress, a more complicated matter with mother-of-pearl buttons down the back, so tiny and numerous that it takes forever before my hands can part the fabric, like a swimmer's dividing water, and slip inside. You will want to know that she was standing by an open window in an upstairs bedroom, motionless, a little wide-eyed, looking out at the orchard below, the white dress puddled at her feet on the wide board hardwood floor. The complexity of women's undergarments in 19th century America is not to be waved off, and I proceeded like a polar explorer through clips, clasps, and moorings, catches, straps, and whalebone stays, sailing toward the iceberg of her nakedness. Later, I wrote in a notebook, it was like riding a swan into the night. But of course, I cannot tell you everything. The way she closed her eyes to the orchard, how her hair tumbled free of its pins, how there were sudden dashes whenever we spoke. What I can tell you is it was terribly quiet in Amherst that Sabbath afternoon. Nothing but a carriage passing the house, a fly buzzing in the window pane. So I could plainly hear her inhale when I undid the very top hook and eye fastener of her corset. And I could hear her sigh when finally it was unloosed, the way some readers sigh when they realize that hope has feathers, that reason is a plank, that life is a loaded gun that looks right at you with a yellow eye. Well, that's a fairly erotic poem for him. Here's one on page 137 called Dharma. The way the dog trots out the front door every morning without a hat or an umbrella, without any money or the keys to her doghouse, never fails to fill the saucer of my heart with milky admiration. Who provides a finer example of a life without encumbrance? Thoreau in his curtainless hut with a single plate, a single spoon? Gandhi with his staff and his holy diapers? Off she goes into the material world with nothing but her brown coat and her modest blue collar, following only her wet nose, the twin portals of her steady breathing, followed only by the plume of her tail. If only she did not shove the cat aside every morning and eat all his food. What a model of self-containment she would be. What a paragon of earthly detachment. If only she were not so eager for a rub behind the ears, so acrobatic in her welcome. If only I were not her God. And then, this is the last one in this book. It's called The Flight of the Reader, 171. You'd think we would have had enough of one another after all the rain streaming down these windows, the walks out to the garden when it clears, the same yellow and white flowers, all the sleepless nights, the toy car going in circles on the bed table. But still, you stay perched on my shoulder, cricket or bluebird, wild parrot, digging your claws into my loud shirt. He's talking to us, the reader. Is it because I do not pester you with the invisible gnats of meaning? Never release the whippets of anxiety from their crates? Or hold up my monstrous mirror, a thing the size of a playing field? makes you stay, I hate to think of that morning when I will wake up to find you gone, heading toward the open sea, dragging the cables that bound us together, leaving me with nothing more to say. But don't get me wrong, it's not that I cannot live without you, cannot sit under an ordinary green tree with no desire to reach for the pin in my pocket, or lie contentedly on a couch all day, one hand over my mouth. It's not like I have a crush on you, and instead of writing my 5-paragraph essay, I am sailing paper airplanes across the room at you. It's not that I can't wait for the lunch bell to see your face again. It's not like that. Not exactly. There's a lot of writing about writers, about writers and their readers, about interpretation, and always drifting off into these elegant and sometimes irreverent metaphors that startle us into another way of thinking about the commonplace. This one is called Searching. I recall someone once admitting that all he remembered of Anna Karenina was something about a picnic basket. And now, after consuming a book devoted to the subject of Barcelona, its people, its history, its complex architecture, all I remember is the mention of an albino gorilla, the inhabitant of a park where the citadel of the Bourbons once stood. The sheer paleness of her looms over all the notable names and dates as the evening strollers stop before her and point to show their children. These locals called her Snowflake, and here she has been mentioned again in print in this poem, in the hope of keeping her pallid flame alive and helping her, despite her name, to endure in this poem where she has found another cage. Oh, Snowflake, I had no interest in the capital of Catalonia, its people, its history, its complex architecture. No, you were the reason I kept my light on late into the night, turning all those pages, searching for you everywhere. We never know what is going to be the thing we remember about a place or a person or an event. Get these books so you can read through, you know, very hard to pick the poems that you'd like to share immediately with others, but they are good. Now this one's called Ballistics, which is the title of this collection, I think the most recent published collection. Ballistics. When I came across the high-speed photograph of a bullet that had just pierced a book, the pages exploding with the velocity, we've all seen this picture, I believe. I forgot all about the marvels of photography and began to wonder which book the photographer had selected for the shot. Many novels sprang to mind, including those of Raymond Chandler, where an extra bullet would hardly be noticed. Nonfiction offered too many choices. A history of Scottish lighthouses, a biography of Joan of Arc, and so forth. Or it could be an anthology of medieval literature, the bullet having just beheaded Sir Gawain and scattered the band of assorted pilgrims. But later, as I was drifting off to sleep, I realized that the executed book was a recent collection of poems written by someone of whom I was not fond, and that the bullet must have passed through his writing with little resistance. At 2,800 feet per second, through the poems about his childhood and the ones about the dreary state of the world, and then through the author's photograph, through the beard, the round glasses, and that special poet's hat he loves to wear. There's a lot of jealousy about that. Other poets. tongue in cheek. I mean, when you're the poet laureate, you can sort of kid this way about being jealous of other poets. Here's one called New Year's Day. Everyone has two birthdays, according to the English essayist Charles Lamb. The day you were born and New Year's Day. A droll observation to mull over as I wait for the tea water to boil in a kitchen that is being transformed by the morning light into one of those brilliant rooms of Matisse. No one ever regarded the 1st of January with indifference, writes Lamb, for unlike Groundhog Day or the Feast of the Annunciation, this one marks nothing but the passage of time. I realized as I lowered a tin diving bell of tea leaves into a little body of boiling water. I admit to regarding my own birthday as the joyous anniversary of my existence, probably because I was, and remain to this day in late December, an only child. And as an only child, a tea-sipping, toast-nibbling only child in a colorful room this morning, I would welcome an extra birthday, one more opportunity to stop what we are doing for a moment and reflect on my being here on Earth. And one more might be a small consolation to us all for having to face a death day too, an X in square on some kitchen calendar in the future. The day when each of us is thrown off the train of time by a burly, heartless conductor as it roars through the months and years. Party hats, candles, confetti, and horoscopes billowing up in the turbulent storm of its wake. Quite a metaphor for the moment of death, but also a troubling thing to think that every year we pass not only our birthday, but our death day, but we don't know which the death day will be. But it will be there on some future calendar, probably. The golden years. All I do these drawn-out days is sit in my kitchen at Pheasant Ridge, where there are no pheasants to be seen, and last time I looked, no ridge. I could drive over to Quail Falls and spend the day there playing bridge. But the lack of a falls and the absence of quail would only remind me of Pheasant Ridge. I know a widow at Fox Run and another with a condo at Smoky Ledge. One of them smokes and neither can run, so I'll stick to the pledge I made to Midge. Who frightened the fox and bulldozed the ledge? I ask in my kitchen at Pheasant Ridge. Must be former poets or English majors, you know, who invent the names for these subdivisions.
Yeah.
Here's one called Despair. So much gloom and doubt in our poetry. Flowers wilting on the table. The self regarding itself in a watery mirror. Dead leaves cover the ground. The wind moans in the chimney, and the tendrils of the yew tree inch toward the coffin. I wonder what the ancient Chinese poets would make of all this, these shadows and empty covers. Today, with the sun blazing in the trees, my thoughts turn to the great 10th century celebrator of experience, Wahoo, whose delight in the smallest things could hardly be restrained, and to his joyous counterpart in the western provinces, Yeehaw! Great American poem. And I always chuckle when I refer to the great American novel, that anyone would have the audacity to entitle his own novel The Great American Novel. Now here's the great American poem. If this were a novel, it would begin with a character, a man alone on a southbound train, or a young girl on a swing by a farmhouse. And as the pages turned, you would be told that it was morning or the dead of night, and I, the narrator, would describe for you the miscellaneous clouds over the farmhouse and what the man was wearing on the train, right down to his red tartan scarf and the hat he tossed onto the rack above his head, as well as the cows sliding past his window. Eventually, one can only read so fast, you would learn either that the train was bearing the man back to the place of his birth, or that he was headed into the vast unknown. And you might just tolerate all of this as you waited patiently for shots to ring out in a ravine where the man was hiding, or for a tall, raven-haired woman to appear in a doorway. But this is a poem, not a novel, and the only characters here are you and I, alone in an imaginary room which will disappear after a few more lines, leaving us no time to point guns at one another or toss all our clothes into a roaring fireplace. I ask you, who needs the man on the train? And who cares what his black valise contains? We have something better than all this turbulence lurching towards some ruinous conclusion. I mean the sound that we will hear as soon as I stop writing and put down this pen. I once heard someone compare it to the sound of crickets in a field of wheat, or, more faintly, just the wind over that field stirring things that we will never see. This one I found only recently, and it's got my name in it, so I figure I have to read it. It's called This Little Piggy Went to Market. This little piggy went to market is the usual thing to say when you begin pulling on the toes of a small child. And I've never had a problem with that. I could easily picture the piggy with his basket and his trotters kicking up the dust on an imaginary road. What always stopped me in my tracks was the middle toe. This little piggy ate roast beef. I mean, I enjoy a roast beef sandwich with lettuce and tomato and a dollop of horseradish, but I cannot see a pig ordering that in a delicatessen. I am probably being too literal-minded here. I am even wondering why it's called horseradish. I should just go along with the beautiful nonsense of the nursery, float downstream on its waters. After all, little Jack Horner speaks to me deeply. I don't want to be the one to ruin the children's party by asking unnecessary questions about Puss in Boots, or again, the implications of a pig eating beef. By the way, I am completely down with going wee, wee, wee all the way home, having done that many times and knowing exactly how it feels. My number. Is death, capital D, is death miles away from this house, reaching for a widow in Cincinnati, or breathing down the neck of a lost hiker in British Columbia? Is he too busy making arrangements, tampering with air brakes, scattering cancer cells like seeds, loosening the wooden beams of roller coasters? Too busy to bother with my hidden cottage that visitors find so hard to find? Or is he stepping from a black car parked at the dark end of the lane, shaking open the familiar cloak, its hood raised like the head of a crow, and removing the scythe from the trunk. Did you have any trouble with the directions, I will ask, as I start talking my way out of this? And here's one called, I'm sorry, I forgot page number on this. This is page 38, called The History Teacher. Trying to protect his students' innocence, he told them the Ice Age was really just the Chili Age. A period of a million years when everyone had to wear sweaters. And the Stone Age became the Gravel Age, named after the long driveways of the time. The Spanish Inquisition was nothing more than an outbreak of questions, such as, how far is it from here to Madrid? What do you call the Matador's hat? The War of the Roses took place in a garden, and the Enola Gay dropped one tiny atom on Japan. The children would leave his classroom for the playground to torment the weak and the smart, mussing up their hair and breaking their glasses, while he gathered up his notes and walked home past flower beds and white picket fences, wondering if they would believe that soldiers in the Boer War told long, rambling stories designed to make the enemy nod off. Okay, then one more. This is a quick one titled Oh My God. These days it would be shortened to OMG. Yeah. Oh my God. Not only in church and nightly by their bedsides do young girls pray these days. Wherever they go, prayer is woven into their talk like a bright thread of awe. Even at the pedestrian mall, outbursts of praise spring unbidden from their glossy lips. Well, that's enough. I hope you enjoyed Billy.